Good morning, James Rebers. I'm Ali Maldrow. My pronouns are she, her, hers, and I'm so grateful to get to join you this morning and worship with you all. I am going to talk about living in with intention or living into your purpose. And I'm going to start with a story, but also with a quote from Martin Luther King, because Martin Luther King Day is tomorrow, and his birthday is actually today. And I think it's important to remember that Martin Luther King died at the age of 39, and as of April 4th of this year, will have been dead for about 53 years, which is significantly longer than he was alive. But this is what Martin Luther King said when he got the Nobel Peace Prize. He said, "I accept this award today with an abiding faith in America and an audacious faith in the future of mankind. I refuse to accept the despair as a final response to the ambiguities of history. I refuse to accept the idea that the isness of man's present nature makes him morally incapable of reaching up for the eternal oughtness that forever confronts him. I refuse to accept the idea that a man is mere flotsam, jotsam in the river of life, unable to influence the unfolding events which surround him. I refuse to accept the view that mankind is so tragically bound to the starless midnight of racism and war that the bright daybreak of peace and brotherhood can never become a reality." Martin Luther King's acceptance speech on the occasion of the award of the Nobel Peace Prize in Oslo, December 10th, 1964. To change the world, we must change ourselves. I have three kids, and I'm telling you that for a couple of reasons. One is because at any point in time, this presentation could be quite interrupted by sibling feuds. So if you hear that in the background, I have a very little baby, and then I have my oldest, and this is actually a story about my oldest, Adrian, who is 12, and we have a middle kiddo, Azzy, who is 7. I told myself a lie when I was pregnant with my oldest kid, and I think it's a lie that a lot of us tell ourselves as parents, and it was really simple. I told myself that I was going to do everything my parents did well, and none of the things that they did poorly would I also do poorly. And I was able to believe that lie for 2 straight years, for the first 2 years of my oldest daughter's life, until we were at Target and she started crying. And I heard my mother's words come out of my mouth. I don't know if you've had that experience yet, but when you do, it's a pretty terrifying thing to just metamorphose into your parents suddenly and out of nowhere. And so there we are. And I said to my 2-year-old at the time, who was having this huge fit, "Do you want a reason to cry?" And if you grew up with "do you want a reason to cry," you know that that is not a question. It's a threat. It's a threat, and it's also a statement of fact. So it's a threat because it's also often followed by "I'll give you a reason to cry." But it's also this statement that you never have a good reason to cry. And my parents are wonderful people who I love in very, very, very much. But they were raising 4 biracial children in the 80s and 90s in the United States of America. And they wanted us to be really constructive, really strong people. And so they kind of raised us to think that crying about things was not a way to solve problems. And I had to think about it in that moment. Did I want to hand down the relationship to crying to my children that I have? I'm not much of a crier. I have a hard time kind of navigating my own feelings sometimes, and I didn't want that for my kids. But I didn't grow up in a house where crying was celebrated or encouraged, and so I didn't have good models for how to do that. I consider myself a pretty smart person and a pretty creative person, and so I told myself there at Target, the next time Adrian cries, I'm going to make it super exciting. I'm going to make it a really big deal. And I'm going to let her know that it's important that she's crying. And lucky for me, y'all, she was 2 years old. We left Target. We got home. She was crying at least like 13 minutes later. So, you know, the test was right there in front of me. And I thought about it for a second and I thought, oh gosh, how do you make it exciting for her to cry? And then I thought, oh, wait, this is great. You guys, this is great, because her toys only drink our tears.
And so I told Adrian, I was like, oh my goodness, it's so good that you're crying because your toys, they only drink tears and they are all dehydrated. You all, I am a teacher through and through. So, you know, this was like, I was winning. I got to explain both that her emotions were valid and dehydration at the same time. I was like, this is the ultimate parenting win. I have done it. I have achieved the break in the cycle that is, you know, not being comfortable with emotion. And so we played that game for 3 years. Every time Adrian cried, her toys drank her tears and we would line them up and they'd take turns. And I'd tell her, you've got to keep crying, Adrian, because they're all so thirsty. And she would cry and she would laugh and we would talk about how important it is to feel our feelings and share those feelings with our friends. And so a few years, 3 years later, when she was about five, she said, you know, I'm not really into this game anymore. She had like a maturing moment. She says, I'm going to kind of deal with my feelings on my own. Thanks for the game. And I thought, that's fine. I'm not completely crushed by this. I will move on, you know? But I wondered if she would remember me having her toys drink her tears the way I remembered, do you want a reason to cry? And it didn't come up for a few years, but when she was about 7 years old, I was running for school board for the first time and I was really rushed. And her sister, Azzy, was 2 years old. And I remember one day I said, Adrian and Azzy, we've really got to get going. And Azzy was super mad because I was doing something horrible, like putting her shoes on, which can be really, you know, that can be like a crossing the line for a two-year-old sometimes, like making them get ready. And she was really upset and I was kind of rushing her. And Adrian said, Mom, you can't rush Azzy. Her toys only drink her tears. And she went and got her sister's toys and she lined them up and they drank her tears. And in that moment, I knew that she could hand that down the same way I had decided not to hand down, do you want a reason to cry? I think so often when we think about our purpose, why we do the things we do, we pretend that it's about other people, right? Like, I would love to say that I'm a teacher and I'm interested in education because I just really, really care about kids. But the truth is it goes back to me and the things that happened to me as a child and the way I was shaped. And so I've been thinking a lot about what it means to break cycles lately and what it means to make decisions that allow for us to do things differently than the way we were raised to do them or taught to do them or talked about. And I talk about leadership as an orientation of the imagination all the time. Great leaders are the people who look at the way the world is and imagine the way the world could be. And so I think I tell that story often because I think it's this one moment in my life where I really examined who I wanted to be as a parent and who I wanted to be as a person. I feel very connected to a sense of purpose, to the idea that I was born in Madison, Wisconsin, and I went to school here and I love this community for a reason. And I really don't like to be cold. So I was not born here to play winter sports. I had to be born here to address a series of dynamics that emerged for me within my life. And so I think the stories of my childhood that stand out, the stories of my own education, my own upbringing that stand out to me are stories of either incredible support or incredible, pain. And I think my course was kind of created for me right from the beginning. When I was in kindergarten, I had a teacher who asked all of the students to spell every word that they knew how to spell. And I knew how to spell the days of the week and my siblings' names. And she didn't acknowledge any of the words I had spelled right. She came over and she said, oh my gosh, I have a brother named Wally too. That's not how you spell your brother's name. And I said, yes, it is. Ask my mom. And you all, I was so excited because I had never been certain I was right and an adult was wrong before. And so I remember she actually did. She called my mom. And while she was calling my mom, I was like rehearsing that I was going to tell her, like, it's okay. We all make mistakes, you know? And I was going to reassure her that it was okay that she didn't know how to spell Wally as well as I did. And she came back to my desk and she said, Ali, I am so sorry. Nobody in your whole family knows how to spell. And I remembered that for years because I was so embarrassed for my mom at the time that this teacher had told me that my mom didn't know how to spell her children's names, that I didn't tell my mom because I actually thought it would really hurt her feelings. And I think about that moment a lot. Like, that teacher could have said, some people spell Sarah with an H and some people don't. Some people use I and some people use Y. But she chose to take that moment where I was different and use it as a way to tell me that I was unintelligent and incapable, and everybody like me was unintelligent and incapable. The people I loved most in the world were incompetent. And I tell people all the time that I got into education for two reasons. One is because I had really, really awful teachers. And the other is because I had absolutely extraordinary teachers. And both of those teachers will make you want to be a teacher. And so I think in ending the story of today and the breaking of the cycle, I think it's important to talk about the people who really allowed for me to challenge the way I saw myself and the way I saw the world. And I think the most important mentors I ever had were people who made it easy for me to feel loved in the classroom. And I'm so grateful to be with you all today, because I think a few years ago, I embraced the idea that we have this huge world and we could spend so much time with so many people. And so anytime we're called together with a group of people, like I've been called with you all today, we're in that space because we're supposed to love each other. And love looks like accountability and responsibility and respect, but it also looks like giving people a space to be themselves and to challenge the world around them. What? And one of the most loving experiences I ever had was having a teacher named Amanda Postel. She was an after-school specialist. She's like 18 years old and I was 12. So I thought she was so mature and so phenomenal. And she was just a fantastic teacher. But I did a project with her and I got a B on it. And I really struggled with school. School was really hard for me. I felt really embarrassed at school and unintelligent at school. And she and I did this project together and I got a B and I was so excited about the B, and I showed it to her and she was outraged. She goes, you know, why didn't you get an A? And I said, I don't know, Amanda, I think a B is a really good grade. And she said, no, you totally should have gotten, you should have gotten an A. And she went down to the teacher's office with me and she said, I did this project with Ali and she should have gotten an A. And the teacher said, oh my gosh, you're right. She should have gotten an A, and she changed my grade. You all, that like instance got me through college, of being able to say, wait, I think that I worked really hard on this and we should talk about how I was graded and it should be fair. But what she really did in that moment was became the first person to recognize and validate my intelligence. And that is, you know, the thing that inspired me to be an educator, was those moments with students. And there's really nothing more precious to me, even now at this point in my career and at this point in my parenting and my life. The moments that I find the most compelling are moments like this. I worked with a student in the Dane County Juvenile Detention Center a few years ago, and everything's a few years ago for me, y'all, because I have three kids. So I can tell you everything Dora did in her whole life, but my own timeline is pretty complex at this point. And so I worked with this young person and, you know, we worked together in the jail for weeks. And every time I would come into the jail, I would ask him, you know, what's your major going to be when you go to college? And he would always say nuclear physics. Every single time. And it was kind of a joke between the two of us. And years later, he sent me a Facebook message and asked me if I had Snapchat. I don't have Snapchat. But I asked him what he was doing and he said, I'm going to Texas, going to college in Texas. And I said, what's your major? And he said, oh, this is, you're going to laugh, but it's nuclear physics. And I said, why did you decide to study that? And he said, like, I bet you don't remember this, but you would always ask me what my major was going to be when you came into the jail. And that question prompted me to get really interested in nuclear physics. And actually, some of the folks in the jail heard that exchange between you and I and gave me some materials, and particularly had shown him this like TV show that really inspired him to major in that. And I think about those little moments that you don't actually think. I don't think Amanda thought when she took me to change my grade that she would change my life and I would remember that forever and I would want to be that for other students. But she did. And I definitely didn't think when I was asking that student what his major would be, that that would change the trajectory of the way he thought of himself. But I think that we have the ability to interrupt narratives, and we have to, because the things that we are used to, the things that are normal in our world and in our society, aren't good enough for us, aren't good enough for our future and our kids. We are used to a sexist society, and we are used to a racist society. And we have every right to dream of a better world. And we also have every right to create a better world, to reimagine the way we interact with each other and the way that we love and the way that we live and the way that we communicate. And so I hope you know that there are a ton of good reasons to cry. And I hope I gave you a couple today. And thank you so much for letting me join you all.